take your protein pills. The Poisoned Electric Head Story. Prologue. It's 1968. I'm 4 years old and perched on my dad's shoulders, amongst the crowd awaiting the approach of the annual town parade. As the procession descends the hill, my infant frame becomes aware of a growing pounding sensation in my chest. It's disturbing, and my first taste of apprehension and foreboding. The source of the discomfort is the increasing proximity of the bass drum, which is leading the parade. Every beat of its skin ricochets into my tiny ribcage like a fist. As the sensation reaches its peak, I'm approached by a man wearing a giant papier-mâché head who hands me an uninflated orange balloon at point-blank proximity. His dead fish eyes and letterbox grin push me over the edge into inconsolable hysterics. At this tender age, I first discover the awesome power of the mask. Chapter 1, 1980 to 1982. In St. Helens, dreams are like head lice. They're nothing to be ashamed of and can be easily got rid of, but better still to keep yourself to yourself and not have them in the first place. Well, I must have sat next to the wrong kids because my head was full of them. Don't worry, I'm not going to drag you through the litany of amusing childhood vignettes a chapter 1 normally imposes on the reader, depicting exhibitionist streaks and precocious displays. We're not in the business of finding reasons and causes. But I will say that my name is Bri, and I'm a member of Poisoned Electric Head, a group that no longer exists, yet always will for the 8 people involved. Poisoned Electric Head never managed to get into the top 10. Just beaten up by the audience, run over by tow trucks, pelted with buckets of human excrement, and mistaken for armed robbers. Twice. When we weren't throwing each other out of moving vehicles and building our own robots, we were turning down 20 grand publishing deals, performing under police helicopter searchlights, and being threatened by 20 Michael Jacksons at once. It cost me 13 years of my life, and it was worth every penny, even the bad trips, bad reviews, nights in the cells, guns in the face, coke-filled suitcases in the dressing room, and acid dealers in the back of the van. As for the music, well, this book is similar, as it jumps around and goes off on tangents before sneaking back up on itself. And like the music, it starts off with one idea, but can't help itself from squeezing in another 5 or 6. The continuity is also a slippery animal at best. It's hard to remember just exactly when it all happened. And reading things I wrote 3 years ago, I hear the voice of a different person, someone more frivolous and less cynical. I'm sitting on a train taking exactly the same journey as yesterday, at the same time, but everything's different, whether it be the subtle seasonal changes of light, or the one-off moments like a passing team of lycra-clad cyclists, or the old man in a beret outside a tower block who has something wrong with his sleeve. The guard makes his rounds after every stop, but never checks the same person twice. What complex mental mechanism is enabling him to do that? A lot of this book's been written on trains, mostly the 704 from Liège to Spa, a placid enough route that steadily creeps up on the cacophony scale with each embarking onslaught of Belgian school kids. I've found a perverse pleasure in trying to gather my thoughts in the face of such adversity. There he goes again, picking out the new elements in the ever-changing pattern. Each passenger must be like the spine of a new CD on the rack, screaming out glaringly from the others. I joined a band for the same reasons as anyone who's ever done so, ranging from a love of music to a deep-seated need to be adored and everything in between. Come the time to leave school, I'd seen plenty of evidence that in St. Helens, the job you chose at 16 clamped itself to you like a tandem parachutist, and the pair of you plummeted into oblivion together, whizzing through mortgage and reproduction and accelerating ever more quickly towards death. Hardly surprising then that I froze at the aircraft doors, refusing to jump. I needed some breathing space, and it presented itself in the form of art college. I had some artistic talent, maybe not enough to build a career on, but enough to be accepted and buy some time for my still evolving personality to gestate. A year previously, that same creative urge had caused me and my best friend Bun to be the only two kids out of a school of 600 to show interest in the youth theatre poster in the corridor, prompting the school to send us to Manchester for 8 weeks to live unsupervised in Students' Hall of Residence at the age of 15. When we returned, the bullies and the streetwise just seemed like little kids to me. The bravado and intimidation they'd traded on since day one had become as flimsy and threatening as the cardboard swords we'd spent all summer fashioning. This brief theatrical experience helped the pair of us get accepted into art college, which was populated with people like us who'd seen the pipe fitter at the gates of school and were equally playing for time. But there were also some genuinely talented kids there, and Phil was one of them. Everything he touched was permeated in Hieronymus Bosch-like scenes of hell. The tutors never commented on how alive his work was, as it had obviously been dead for some time and was beginning to smell. The college was hideously biased towards styles that were in vogue when the tutors were students, so Hockney was what we had to aspire to if we knew which side our bread was buttered. It was a shock to discover that this haven of creativity was anything but, for it had a glowing record of placing students on prestigious degree courses and wasn't about to jeopardise it by giving them artistic licence to express themselves. Phil's grotesque creations were tolerated by grace of their technical excellence, but work was often mocked and openly derided if it didn't fit the mould. Maybe they were trying to hammer home how fiercely competitive an arena we were about to enter. Or perhaps they were just bitter and cynical at their own failure to set the art world alight. Either way, the battle lines were drawn. At the heart of the place sat Critchley, like a cantankerous old spider. He was strictly old boy network from the school of art is bloody hard work, the art world's equivalent of a Monty Python sketch. When I were a lad, I got up at 5, got a damn good hiding from Stanley Spencer and painted 8 Sistine Chapel ceilings before breakfast. He was a cross between Melvin Bragg and Grandpa from the Munsters and the proud architect of the monstrous fountain that stood in the town centre, resembling the middle bit of the TARDIS that goes up and down during takeoff. Its efforts to raise the cultural tone of the town were regularly thwarted by some wag throwing a box of Daz in at the first sign of hot weather. I swear some days in a certain light, you could almost see Charlie Watts sat in it, soldiering gamely on amongst the suds. Yet, despite their faults, you couldn't help liking the tutors, Selwyn, the eccentric deputy head, who had a penchant for throwing hammers, and Kate, a petite intellectual goddess with the poise of a dancer. Think Margot Fonteyn, but with a kinky streak. The source of 1,000 adolescent crushes. And I don't regret the time I spent there. In between the life classes and gouache thefts, we passed our days daydreaming about forming a band. Synthesizers only, of course. And just as Phil had the artistic edge, he was also streets ahead musically. Not only could he actually play an instrument, but he was already in a band, a punk outfit called Subversion. Sometime between 1982 and 85, Subversion split, and some members went on to join the Aristocrats. Subversion's finest moment was supporting the UK subs at Eric's, the legendary Liverpool punk club. I remember the tough kids in woodwork lessons going on about Eric's, discussing who they were going to watch there that night. I was 13 or 14 at the time, and the concept of accompanying them, or indeed making my own way to a punk club in the big city, just seemed impossible. So the Skids concert was just a distant dream. The following week, I missed out again, but big time on that occasion. The first ever UK appearance of Devo, a band that would go on to have an enormous influence on me. But I didn't go. We were not men. A year or so later, I would cut my teeth watching The Damned at the Factory in Manchester during my theatrical rite of passage, an exhilarating, adrenaline-charged night in an equally legendary venue, the embryonic birthplace of Factory Records and Joy Division. You win some, you lose some, With Subversion, I finally got to set foot in Eric's as part of the entourage of stagehands and crazies. There was a slightly older guy along named Stan, who was doing onstage security, which involved launching any lunatics trying to invade it. He seemed to be something of a mentor to Billy, and I overheard him dispensing sagely advice to him throughout the night. "I used to be timid and shy like you once," he remarked, which struck me as incongruous, as the Billy I knew was far from shy and retiring. Volatile and dangerous were closer to the mark. His pretty girlfriend Azo was always attracting attention from guys at gigs, and it nearly always resulted in these hapless would-be suitors needing the medical kind. Various other art college characters had a foot in the door with the music industry. Mike Badger in the year above was just forming the Lars, and Roy Corkill was bass player with Black. Roy now plays with Ian McNabb. So the whole idea was intoxicatingly feasible. Those 2 years at art college were a time of discovering music, clubs, drugs and girls. The pre-Raphaelites didn't get a look in. I remember one occasion that for some reason is hardwired into my consciousness. Sarah Mers's 18th birthday party and the after-hours session back at her parents' place. What makes one night leave such an impression above so many others? The sounds and smells and sensations of it. I can recreate it effortlessly and still feel the chill wind blowing in from the patio doors someone had chosen to open in the early hours. Lying comatose on the couch, shivering in the knowledge that the seductively adept amongst us had copped off, the music on the stereo forever welded to that moment. All the senses posing together for a rare group shot. Me, unaware of how seldom that occurs, and that people spend lives and fortunes trying to cajole that disparate five back together for a brief reunion. Inevitably, when it came to degree course interviews, a three-strike system, a lot of us struck out, even Phil, whose colossal talents were ignored as he didn't have the academic requirements. Among my team of also-rans were the following.
Sadowski.
A raucous skinhead of Polish descent with a Jonathan Ross lisp and a passion for big motorbikes, big breasts and Frank Frazetta's fantasy art.
Christine Eastham.
Diminutive rock chick with a Jane Mansfield chest. Much admired by the above.
Pete Webster.
Chiselled cheekboned Bowie-phile. Loved fight scenes in black and white films where the brill-creamed hair of Bounders flopped forward upon being chinned. Because of his slight frame, my dad frequently commented that he looked like he could do with a butty.
Tom Barry.
A lone rock fan in a sea of punks and adamant fans. His ultra-cool sister used to invite Julian Cope round for his haircut. Wasn't keen on shagging when the dog was watching.
Ken.
Morose scouser with permanent nasal congestion. Looked like Serge Gainsbourg. I hope he's capitalised on the fact.
Dave Evans.
Enfant terrible of the group, with a Warhol fixation and a nifty line in confrontational pieces painted in jam. Most of the others obtained places at various colleges, thus managing to escape St. Helens and its grey skies, peppery pies and chemical highs. As for the rest of us left behind, the next step was unclear, but creativity was still coursing madly through our veins. And in a violent industrial town, it was the only weapon we had. Chapter 2. Meet the Band. I don't expect you to follow this tale without some confusion, but I can at least endeavour to minimise it. Thus, it's time you met the key players. Despite a slew of nicknames and pseudonyms used over the years, the following people will only be referred to as the primary names given here. For some of the people in the book, names have been changed to protect the innocent, me. It was implied to me that certain characters mentioned within could either be chuffed and dine off the infamy indefinitely or track me down and break my legs. There's also a slight chance they could break my legs for changing the names. But that seems to be the best odds, so I'm sticking with it. Bun, bass guitar, co-founder of the Deadfly Studios along with myself, and my best and oldest friend. Dependable would be most people's adjective of choice to describe him. A guy not given to flights of fancy, and always prepared to look reality square in the face. In our teenage years, his good looks were a constant thorn in my side. Girls trampled over me to get a glimpse of him. Not one to suffer fools gladly, which is a pity, as for 13 years, he was inextricably hooked up with a bunch of them. In the band, he provided the archetypal bass player's role, both musically and personally, a solid rock in a sea of chaos. Bill, the drums. Clichés surrounding drummers must come from someplace, and Bill was that place. 6 foot six, with hands like shovels, an ability to drink amounts that would kill lesser mortals, and a less than passing interest in any aspect of the band that didn't involve playing his kit or getting shit-faced afterwards. But if you delved a little further, you found a guy who was quite shy and a deep thinker. In an ideal world, he would have been Australian, given his aptitude for drinking and sports. He could do two really good impressions, Burt Lancaster and Plug from the Beano. Phil, guitar. The most talented guy I've ever met. He made everyone else at art college look like a waste of space, and was an excellent guitarist to boot. If you put the following into a rock and roll computer, tattoos, piercings, Sid's leather jacket and sneer, studs, Keith's Gibson and skull rings, shaven head, black-only clothing, then Phil would come out the other end. He looked the part, and he played it with heart. Funny, warm and charismatic. If you're going to have a lead guitarist, then have a proper one. Billy, guitar. Deep-set blue eyes, a Roman nose and a fuck-you expression. A multifaceted conundrum of contradictions. The youngest member of the band, yet the most mature. A father figure 1 minute and an unruly child the next. Reliable yet unstable. Wise beyond his years, yet hopelessly naive. Drunken thug, yet esoteric mystical scholar. Technically, not the greatest guitarist, but a frighteningly imaginative one. And like the rest of the band, once you became his friend, it was for the duration. Al, sound engineer. My younger brother, a bona fide member of the band, but always fighting against the stigma that not being on stage with the rest of us implied. He did most of the driving, and without his tireless dedication to the bigger picture, a lot of things wouldn't have happened. We, of course, took him for granted and took the piss. It was his own fault for looking like Mickey Dolenz, and maybe a little Burt Reynolds on the side. P, vocals. Shy off stage and often reclusive, but on stage you couldn't take your eyes off him. Being naturally blessed with a physique to rival Iggy Pop's obviously helped. Yet despite not being a natural raconteur and often appearing uncomfortable in social situations, he had no qualms about wearing his own homemade clothes, red, green and black ensembles, and dancing in clubs in the strangest manner, a kind of twitchy hybrid of David Byrne and Jello Biafra. I could never quite work him out, but his closely guarded internal philosophy seemed to be a good one. Due to the frenetic singing style he and AF engaged in, the words often didn't come across. But if you took the time to read them, you soon discovered he was an exceptional lyricist. AF, vocals. Where do I begin? When they made AF, Andy Ford, they broke the mould, for everyone's sake. The English language is richer than most, but falls short of describing AF. Infuriating, perplexing, mad, bad, and dangerous to know. Mischievous, a grinning, malevolent imp, a trickster, a sleight-of-hand opportunist, the funniest man I've ever met, a cross between Ray Winston and Sergeant Bilko. He could drive you to despair, but you couldn't help but like him. Suffice to say, the book you're holding would be a pamphlet, were it not for AF. Bri, keyboards. And as for me, I'm there to make up the numbers. Being the fourth child of five with two older brothers and a big sister, it was always thus. When we were kids, I could never be Captain Scarlet. I was too far down the pecking order. I had to be Colonel White, the old guy in the wheelchair. My sister, bless her, tried to rationalise these play-acting disputes by playing down the attributes of Captain Fantastic and the Human Torch, and bigging up being made of orange rocks, but I was never fooled. Yet, in a strange way, I've always been drawn towards the less obvious characters. It's like they're defined by what they're not. So, I'm Mike in The Young Ones, Stan in South Park, and Scotty in Star Trek. But Bri, he's the most important character. They'd never be able to beam down if it weren't for him. Don't feel sorry for me, though, because you get to view this story through my eyes. But with such a colourful cast around me, then my role in all of this is clear. I'm the other one. Chapter 3, I Am the Fly. So, after a unanimous vote of no confidence by the art school system for all concerned, we happily drifted into blissful unemployment, a path that offered reasonable money for our needs and infinite free time to further pursue our psychotropic explorations. Bun and myself could also now concentrate on trying to make the synth band concept tangible reality. Desires to achieve this dominated our every waking moment, and we quickly adopted the behaviour of stars in the making, convinced that we were already famous and merely the only ones aware of this inevitable and soon to be universally known fact. The daily procession of schoolgirls up the main road at the end of Bun's Avenue would soon whisper and point in muted admiration and ill-concealed pubescent lust. The future was ours for the taking. Phil Oakey from the Human League appeared in the NME, saying that if previous interviews had given the impression that anyone could have a big hit if they had an octave cat or a wasp, then that blatantly wasn't the case, and there was a lot more to it. This backtracking approach was surely Martin Rushent's idea, the white-hot producer of the multi-million-selling Dirr, or Oakey's attempt to skirt off the opposition and retain the crown of synth-pop for himself. After all, even his old band members had broken away from the league and were now in direct competition. Either way, none of this remotely swayed us from dragging our long-suffering parents down to Dawson's Music to act as guarantors on extortionate hire purchase agreements, and analogue synthesizers were duly acquired. Rumour had it that a guy named Dave Peebles had an SH-101. This being a Roland synth, the instrument of choice of such demigods as Oakey, Almond and Dolby, instantly made Peebles a marked man, and tracking him down and recruiting him became priority one. In those days, we would have recruited Hannibal Lecter if he'd owned a Moog. Electronic gear had a hypnotic, almost erotic hold on me, and when faced with the choice of a holiday in Ireland with Bun and his family, or the purchase of a Boss Dr. Rhythm drum machine, I chose the beatbox. The path of least resistance. It seemed the only way. Some years later, I would give it to a guy named Tweak to repair, and never see it again. Bun's brother Mark had briefly flirted with the bass guitar, and his now redundant amp was swiftly purloined for the cause. Dave Peebles joined in on those early sessions, which consisted of primitive attempts at Kraftwerk's The Model and Radioactivity, and Depeche Mode's Just Can't Get Enough. Me and Bun were in raptures at these rudimentary takes on electropop, but Dave was notably less enthused, and finally revealed that his musical preferences lay somewhere to the right of Throbbing Gristle. But he stayed long enough to take part in our first gig, a Battle of the Bands which also featured Subversion. And he gave us our name, the Academy of Unrest. Looking back, it was an obvious copy of Kirk Brandon's vitriolic punk combo, Theatre of Hate. Years later, Poison That Chickhead got to play with Theatre of Hate, with the inevitable disastrous results. But we needed a name for the competition, and we also needed some songs. Quite often, our days were spent hanging around the local college refectory, drinking tea and perving over hairdressing students. And it was here that word of our combo reached Doug Eglin, a sociology student and keen guitarist, looking for a musical outfit. He offered to join in for the competition and donated one of the songs he had written, which would stretch our set to the required 15 minutes duration. At the last minute, his friend Juliet came on board as backing vocalist, and we performed a dubious debut, consisting of a 10-minute synth dirge, followed by Doug's semi-acoustic folk ballad, Welcome to the Dawn. Suffice to say, the judge's enthusiasm was less than overwhelming, and we limped in at 10th place. But the seductive allure of the stage had dug its sleazy claws into us, and there would be no going back. Dave swiftly left, and Doug asked to join. And as he was a real musician and could sing, we said yes. Things evolved into a more traditional rock outfit, and we searched for a drummer, eventually settling with a guy called Flynn, who also frequented the college. This extended lineup made rehearsing in Bun's bedroom impossible, much to the relief of his parents and the neighbours. A fortunate thing, bearing in mind that his dad had recently engaged in a fist fight over the hedge with the bloke opposite. We watched from the upstairs window, cheering him on, as Bun's mum screamed, "Peter, don't. He's an old man, you'll kill him." Happy days. We did the rounds of back rooms in pubs in the YMCA until Gneganor, yet another college acquaintance, whose real name, Gaynor, had been inexplicably extended with extra consonants to become Gneganor, offered us the use of the barn on her dad's farm. Her elder brother Chad was a big soul and funk fan, the original funk soul brother. He dressed like Nile Rodgers and was once spotted crying in a nightclub because he wasn't black. He got into mixing and scratching quite early on, winning the National DJ Awards, which landed him a spot on Blue Peter. He later went on to have a top 10 hit with Hear the Drummer Get Wicked under the name Chad Jackson, no doubt in reference and reverence to his hero Michael. With such success and musical talent around the place, we were duly inspired and set about becoming the next Southern Death Cult, amassing a collection of angry songs, part Cult, part Cure, with a liberal dash of Killing Joke. We'll be right back. Around this time, we had made the acquaintance of Eddie Edwards, a mental nurse who was a cross between Dale Winton and Sidney Poitier, and shared the same flair for disaster as his ski-jumping namesake. He was a whirlwind of enthusiasm tempered with camp conservatism, and like the character in Rising Damp, he was rumoured to be the son of an African chief. One memorable night, he invited a dozen of us from the college to his halls of residence on the mental hospital grounds for one of his parties. The intention was that Eddie's neighbouring tenants along the landing would open their doors and the party would flow around the corridor and various rooms. On the ground floor was a communal lounge and TV area, which Eddie pointed out to us on arrival as a possible chill-out zone should anyone require brief respite from the antics upstairs. What he didn't know was that we were all in possession of copious amounts of magic mushrooms. And no one was about to tell him, what with him being in the medical profession and quite straight-laced in his views on recreational drug use. Things went fine at first. His workmates thought we were nice enough, if a little strange. The long bouts of unprovoked laughing fits and the passing round of a Rod Stewart album sleeve as if it were a magic eye picture probably didn't help. Eventually, escalating paranoia crept in. And in the midst of the chaos, me and my mate decided that the dark refuge of the TV room would maybe sort our heads out. Socialising with strangers had become impossible to the point of terror, and the corridor outside offered scant relief as it had metamorphosised into the deck of a ship. We bounded downstairs and cautiously crept into the darkened room. A squeaking noise from behind the couch alerted us to the fact that we were not alone. I hastily flicked the lights on to reveal our whole entourage skulking sheepishly in collective drug miasma. The squeak had emanated from Bun, who had found and befriended a bottle of washing up liquid in the adjoining kitchen and had named it Mr. Palmolive. All decisions and thoughts from that point onward were reached through consultation with Mr. Palmolive, who denied or affirmed each question with a squeak and a salvo of bubbles from his tiny head, and the pair of them made it clear they wanted the light off again. Not the wisest behaviour to be engaged in when in a mental institution. Things went from bad to worse when Eddie appeared. He tracked down the whereabouts of his ever-decreasing party guests to the TV room and wasn't best pleased. Nor was he about to be convinced by a detergent bottle that it was in everybody's best interest that we stay there. A cringing scene ensued as Eddie's angry shouts echoed around the brightly lit room, almost visibly bouncing off the sterile green walls. Bun reluctantly emerged from behind the couch, and we were all frog-marched back to what was left of his party. Mr. Palmolive remained downstairs. A few hours later, Eddie finished us off completely by taking us to the works canteen in the bowels of the main hospital building, where we encountered dispossessed and deranged patients along the route. The mentally ill aren't the best complement to a hallucinogenic come-down, but we were glad of the 4 a.m. fry-up. And some weeks later, Eddie finally forgave us, and we went on to become good friends. He was enamoured with the spirit of free enterprise that the 80s appeared to embody, and was forever chasing potential grants and spurious government incentives. It was Eddie who suggested we'd run the band as a newly formed business, taking advantage of the £40 a week allowance scheme. But we found that we were ineligible, as we were already a going concern. We could have easily disbanded, changed the name and tried again, but instead, we hit upon the idea of rehearsal rooms for local musicians and ourselves to use. There were precious little places available for bands, as we had discovered. And as the barn had been reclaimed by its owners for more agricultural needs, it seemed a logical opportunity. Eddie seized the chance to immerse himself in this intoxicating world of projection plans, small business advisors, and start-up costs on our behalf. And before we knew it, there were men in suits falling over themselves to prize us out of the dole queue and into the Chamber of Commerce. We played along with the arrogance and cool detachment that youth provides as a substitute to having no concept of the real world. The venture quickly developed into a triumph of enthusiasm over common sense, as profit viability and market potential were papered over and barely touched upon in the mad dash to be up and running, and a search for suitable premises ensued. Our advisors located various possible vacant properties, two of these standing out for different reasons. The first was a Victorian terrace, originally built to house mill workers' families, that was devoid of furniture, but blessed with a more macabre decor. Flies, hundreds of them, all dead. They occupied every available surface, floors, window ledges, shelves, and floating in long discarded cups and glasses. In some rooms, they'd been swept up into a neat pile like autumn leaves. The place was an insect graveyard, a long-lost mausoleum to the humble bluebottle. It was 10 Rillington Place, 30 Cromwell Street, and the Bates Motel. A Bug's Life, remade by Tarantino, and to our twisted teenage minds, poetic. But on a more practical level, it was flanked either side by domestic dwellings, the occupants of which, when faced with invading hordes of musicians, would probably come out on the side of the flies. The second property in the same block was actually part of the old mill, and we were informed that this was where orphan children lived when they weren't being exploited in the adjoining dark satanic bit. This was all turning into quite a history lesson, and with hindsight, it's not hard to work out why these places were vacant and pushed in our direction. But we had history of our own that we were itching to make, and this was the ideal place to start. A cottage industry continuing the tradition of exploiting the town's young in hazardous surroundings. Our inquiries into the first property unearthed the story that the previous tenant had been a lonely recluse whose solitary death at the bottom of the stairs remained undiscovered for several weeks until the emergency services forced an entry. His rapidly decomposing corpse was blocking the door and disintegrated on impact. This little gem of urban folklore settled our choice of name, and the Deadfly Studios were born. Our landlord gave us a couple of months rent-free in order to renovate and prepare the place for commercial use. As we were both still living with our parents, the concept of owning our own building was incredibly seductive and exciting, and opened up vistas of forbidden pleasures. Loud music, unrestricted pot smoking and drug use could all be freely indulged in, not to mention the untapped sexual opportunities with the girls who frequented the local Muso hangouts. Paradise indeed. We wasted no time in decking the office out with a sofa, or was it a mattress, and a hi-fi, and did some primitive soundproofing in the rooms with old carpets. The final touch was to board all the windows up. It was hardly Abbey Road, but the type of clientele we were looking to attract weren't exactly in the Michael Jackson Big Earners League, and would be no strangers to squalor. Damp and discomfort is as much a part of being in a band as amps and alcohol. The service they were paying for was the freedom to make a racket away from the moans and hassles of the interfering public. We weren't about to provide a hospitality lounge and flunkies in monkey suits. The office decor was completed with some cheap Scooby-Doo wallpaper, and we were in business. Take your protein pills. To be continued.
Poisoned electric head, poisoned electric head, poisoned electric head, poisoned poison electric.